And as the horn sounds, it's been a long 10 years, but once more, the Los Angeles Lakers are NBA champions. LeBron James leading the Lakers to a record-tying 17th title and the fourth in his remarkable career, punctuating it with a triple-double. Lakers on the floor celebrating, closing out the bubble here at Disney.
The Los Angeles Lakers are your 2020 NBA champions after what is the longest and strangest season in basketball history. Dave McMenamin explains just how much this title means to LA and LeBron James. And then Bill Barnwell brings us the latest around the NFL on Dak Prescott's season-ending injury, the Raiders beating Patrick Mahomes, and the latest COVID schedule shuffle. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Monday, October 12th. This is ESPN Daily.
And after 3 months, one team has emerged victorious. The Los Angeles Lakers are the NBA's 2019-20 champions. This Larry O'Brien trophy, and I believe this suitcase, are yours.
You guys, come take the trophy.
3, 2, 1. Dave McMenamin, it is about 1 a.m. at the end of the longest season in NBA history. So where do you find yourself specifically right now? What is the scene around you at this moment?
I'm in a pitch black shuttle bus headed from Advent Health Arena, where they played game 6 of the finals, and making the 15-minute ride or so to the Coronado Springs Resort, where we've been living in the bubble for the last several months, seeing this NBA season to its finale.
All right, Dave. So I want you to shed some light for us, as it were, because I watched this game from home, of course, and I watched the Lakers blow the Heat all the way out of the building in this game. So how would you describe what the Lakers did from your vantage point? How dominant was this team on this particular night?
I think it's telling when we heard Rob Pelinka talk about Rajon Rondo and the message he brought to the team yesterday in their film session, really drilling down to everyone that, like, the only way we're going to win this thing is through defense. And they all were disappointed by the effort they had in game 5. You know, they were a little extra. They broke out the Mamba jerseys, even though that wasn't scheduled to be worn that game. Anthony Davis wore the, you know, trophy-colored sneakers. And they just didn't play their game. And in game 6, it was completely different. They were able to contain Jimmy Butler. You started Alex Caruso, and Caruso was getting up in Duncan Robinson's jersey, not giving him easy looks. Anthony Davis was flying all over the place, making the type of plays that made many people believe he was the defensive player of the year this season. And they gave themselves a cushion where they were able to just enjoy the championship experience and soak it in a little bit longer than most teams get to do, because they were up 20 for most of the second half.
Yeah, the second half, it felt like the celebration had already begun, and I understand why, given the giant lead they'd built. But Dave, you alluded to some of the larger context to this series and to the specific team, because the Lakers winning this title in the bubble in Orlando in the midst of a pandemic after the season goes on hiatus with a court that says Black Lives Matter painted on it. And this is the team that had to deal with the fact that in January, a huge part of their heart went away when Kobe Bryant and his daughter Gianna, along with several others, died in this helicopter crash. So how do you even begin to unravel the meaning in totality of this championship for this edition of the Lakers?
It's really hard to, and I think whenever we look back at it, there's only going to be one bubble champion. And so you can't extrapolate what they accomplish in a basketball sense from all the other burdens that were placed upon them this season. I was with this team in China about 360 days ago, where we didn't know, after flying halfway across the world, whether games are going to be played, because there was an international crisis going on based on Daryl Morey tweeting support of Hong Kong protesters.
Right.
And that's become the footnote of footnotes. But that was an experience at the time that was, you know, pretty traumatic for this group that had just come together. But it ended up infusing them with a sense of camaraderie and rapport that I don't think they would have had. And that is what carried them through all the trials and tribulations of this season.
So the GM of this team is Rob Pelinka. And famously, he was the agent, the best friend to Kobe Bryant. When you were roaming the arena tonight and getting to listen to these guys in the aftermath of their win, how did Kobe figure into this?
It was everywhere. Kobe was everywhere. Rob Pelinka told us that during this 95-day stay down here in the bubble, that sometimes he would hear Kobe Bryant's voice in his head late at night, and he was telling him, you got to stay the course, you got to finish the job. And Rob said, I think my friend is proud of me tonight. You know, he was like a son to that Jeannie Buss that she never had. He was a adversary, but also an idol of LeBron James. He was the standard bearer for a franchise for two decades. And they all were inspired by him in their own way.
So you mentioned that Rob would hear Kobe's voice telling him to stay the course, to finish the job. Remind me how this season started, because the NBA season opener was Lakers-Clippers. This was back on October 22nd, 2019. Remind us where the Lakers left things off at the end of last season and what they had to prove.
Last year was a disaster. They pulled off one of the greatest coups in franchise history and convincing LeBron James to come to their team as a free agent in the summer of 2018, when they had been going through the worst period in franchise history. And LeBron comes, and rather than making things better, it seemed like the drama spiked through the roof. And if it wasn't LeBron getting injured and then doing things like drinking wine as he entered into the arena for a game while he was hurt, it was Magic Johnson shocking the franchise and shocking the Buss family, who he considers family, by not informing them before he stepped down before the season finale. It was Luke Walton losing his job as head coach and shortly thereafter being accused of, you know, sexual assault.
So this did feel like a team that was built in LeBron's image. And the Anthony Davis combination, Dave, with LeBron, it more than delivered in the end. And he seemed to be the perfect complement to LeBron James. And we heard LeBron say recently that this is exactly why he wanted Anthony Davis. This is why he brought Anthony Davis to the Lakers. How would you describe how this pairing worked out in the finals?
Well, first of all, let's just go to the numbers, right? The first pair of teammates in NBA history to both average 25 points or more while shooting 50% or better from the floor for an entire postseason run. So in one sense, they're the best pairing we've ever seen where the games truly matter. But beyond that, it is the mutual respect and kind of the big brother, little brother thing. You know, I covered LeBron in Cleveland, and there were times where him and Kyrie Irving would be like oil and water, because, quite frankly, Kyrie didn't feel like he needed LeBron to put his arm around him or show him the way. He chafed at that type of guidance. Whereas Anthony seemed to embrace it, and also, like, he recognized that LeBron could be better. And so they had this rapport. Anthony asked him about it post-game tonight, and he said, like, listen, like, we just spend a lot of time with one another, and I think we want better for each other than we actually want for ourselves.
And it certainly worked out.
You do know LeBron about as well as anybody. I mean, having covered him in Cleveland, Dave, having covered previous title runs, this was LeBron's fourth title with his third team, his fourth finals MVP. And so after a 17-year career at age 35, what is different about this version of LeBron James? What does this specific championship signify in his evolution as a player?
I think he's recognized, one, that he does know a lot about the NBA and how it works, and he has a clear vision of what he believes needs to occur from training camp until the end of the playoffs in order for a team to win the championship. But he's someone who recognizes the importance of building the team bond in order to have those tough moments. Mm. To me, I first started to notice it with this team around Christmas time, where JaVale McGee, right, has an ugly sweater party. Every single player, LeBron included, is going to use a rare off night to not only show up and take photos and support the cause that JaVale was raising awareness and charitable donations for, but he's going out and picking out an ugly sweater. And he's looking, you know, kind of silly and kind of foolish, but it's okay because I'm not LeBron James' global icon. I'm LeBron James, JaVale McGee's teammate. And I'm going to listen to what he has to say and invest in this team.
It's funny, when Frank Vogel, the actual coach, got hired, he was the third choice. It seemed like it may be a setup for another kind of classic LeBron coach dynamic that maybe was going to be fruitful, but also maybe was going to fall into a ditch at some point and be pretty soap opera-like, just because it didn't seem like Vogel was his guy. But as it turns out, Frank Vogel is the man putting together a defense that ends up being as dominant tonight as we've really ever seen a defense be in the finals. So what did Frank Vogel prove to you over the course of this season?
For one, and I never had the privilege of covering him, but I'm from the Philadelphia suburbs. Frank is a Jersey Shore guy. Chuck Daly, I have heard stories over the years of just being this guy with, you know, obviously went to University of Pennsylvania, two-time championship head coach of the Pistons, was the coach of the Dream Team. Being a guy with this kind of like East Coast confidence, kind of a slick talker, great communicator, Frank reminds me of him. Being able to be comfortable in any room, being able to make sure that if a guy's not playing, he's talking to him and telling them why, so the person feels connected to the group. And those things get you through the course of a regular season. And in the playoffs, it's all about having the acumen, having the basketball mind, having the level of preparation to deal with some really good coaches he went up against. You know, Vogel's a lifer. He's a basketball dork. And he has been able to be in the presence of a basketball genius. And I think he wants people to recognize, like, you might think you understand the NBA, you don't. Frank Vogel does understand the NBA, and because of that, he understands the greatness of LeBron James.
So you got this video of LeBron in repose, a champion for the fourth time, calling his mom, Gloria James.
I had to leave the locker room. They're going crazy in here right now. I had to get away. Oh, I love you. I love you. You're the reason that I'm even. You are the reason why I'm able to even do this, mom. You understand? 16 years old, you bring a little ass, big head ass boy into the world. Everything that you've been through, everything that I've seen,
LeBron was smoking a cigar, had the goggles on, had already come out a couple times to mess with us in the media and spray all of us with champagne because we weren't allowed in the locker room like we normally would be for a championship celebration because of social distancing. So he still made sure all of us messed up our suits. But, you know, he was trying to talk to Gloria, who did not make the trip to Orlando at any point. She's back in Akron. She has been doing great things with the I Promise school that he has there. And you can tell and you can admire this relationship that they still have. And it was interrupted by Kentavious Caldwell-Pope and Marquis Morris coming over and dousing LeBron in champagne. It was a celebration, but I think there were moments of reflection.
Dave McMenamin, I can smell the champagne on you from my home in New York. I appreciate you joining me. I appreciate you shedding some light on the ending to the most absurd and wonderful NBA season I can remember.
I appreciate it, Pablo. So far, the champagne's just on my suit, not on my breath, but once I get working on a couple stories, we'll see if that can change.
All right, coming up, the illustrious Bill Barnwell joins the show to run through the biggest NFL storylines from a shockingly crazy Sunday.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Bill Barnwell, it is Sunday night again, and I will be totally honest with you. When this day started, I was assuming this was going to be one of the more boring conversations we were going to have. I didn't know what we were going to talk about. And with all due respect to Viking Seahawks, we got so many enormous stories, none of them more enormous than what happened to Dak Prescott.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's as if the year 2020 and the NFC East came together to deliver the appropriate story. And somehow that landed, unfortunately, on Dak Prescott.
We saw Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott suffer a truly brutal right ankle injury, which turned out to be a compound fracture and dislocation. And this happened late in the third quarter of their game against the Giants.
And here's a quarterback draw up the middle. Prescott bouncing out to the left across the 20. He's inside the Sherwin-Williams red zone. 19.
Boy, and he's hurt. Dak Prescott's hurt. I didn't like the way he fell.
And so Andy Dalton came in at quarterback. The Cowboys ended up winning 37-34 against the Giants. But really, we're here to talk about this injury. And we hope for the best. We learned that he will get surgery tonight as we speak. But Bill, what happened here?
Yeah, I mean, it really was just a freak thing. You know, Prescott was running with the football. He was trying to break a tackle, and his ankle got caught underneath veteran Giants defender Logan Ryan. We see high ankle sprains occasionally happen from this sort of injury. It was just an awkward play. I mean, Prescott sat up, and it was almost as if he didn't realize what had happened. He really didn't react until, you know, we saw that his ankle was turned in the wrong direction. Even Tony Romo was saying that he hoped it was a cramp. By all accounts, Prescott should be able to return and continue what has been an impressive career so far. But the sad news is his season is over. Dak had thrown for more passing yards through four games than anybody in the history of the National Football League by a considerable margin. He was in the middle of a special season, and there just really aren't any guarantees that the Prescott we saw in 2019 and for the first four and a half games of 2020 is the guy we'll see when he comes back.
Yeah, and so we're left with this image of Dak Prescott crying, sadly dapping up all his teammates from atop this injury cart as he's biting down on this towel as if, like, that's how you deal with the pain at that moment. But the pain in terms of the contract stuff, Bill. That's the other element to the Dak Prescott saga here. And so it seems safe to say that if this had happened last year, when he was on the final year of his rookie deal and making way less money than he is now, it would be an even worse scenario. But run through this for me. What does this mean for Dak's career and what the team is going to do with him this season?
So strangely, it might not impact things all that much. So Prescott was playing on the franchise tag for this season, a one-year, fully guaranteed deal for $31.4 million. He gets that regardless of whether he suffered the injury or not. Now, the Cowboys had the right next year to either franchise Prescott again for $37.7 million on a one-year deal, sign him to a long-term contract, or let him leave as an unrestricted free agent. And I think the first of those three options, a second franchise tag, was always going to be the most likely option of the three. And strangely, I think this maybe makes it even more likely now. Both Prescott and the Cowboys would probably prefer at this point to go to a second franchise tag and see what Dak looks like next season after he returns from injury. And the Cowboys, on the whole, were already a mess before the Prescott injury. And now Andy Dalton is their starting quarterback. And he is a quarterback who has struggled badly over the past two seasons while playing behind a dismal offensive line in Cincinnati. And Dalton did just enough on Sunday with a couple late completions to get the Cowboys in position for a game-winning field goal. And maybe the one bright spot for the Cowboys in light of the Prescott injury is that at 2-3, they're now in first place in the NFC East.
Speaking of the life cycle of an injury, hours before we saw what happened to Dak Prescott, we saw the return, the dramatic return of Alex Smith. And Alex Smith, 2 years ago, we saw him get carried off the field, suffering a broken leg that was as gruesome as any injury that anyone can remember. It turned into a medical nightmare that led to him losing a huge amount of the flesh on his leg. There was an infection. His life was threatened by sepsis, that blood infection. And we've detailed this on this podcast, on E60, the incredible persistence and determination that he had to return to play.
When you were in the middle of, you know, having multiple surgeries that you do not know the number of at this point, not even sure if you would keep your leg, did you ever think that would even be a possibility?
No, I mean, I was scared it wasn't. I guess I felt like I knew it was the hard decision to try to put that out there and to chase it. I feel like, you know, I was confronted with this, and I still am confronted with this great challenge, you know, and it's a great opportunity. And certainly, I could elect not to do it and walk away from football and go play golf and enjoy my kids the rest of my life. But I just feel like, even though that's the easy decision and the hard thing was trying to chase this, I don't feel like walking away was the right decision. I wanted to see how far I could take this. I know that if I can go and play quarterback again, there's nothing I won't be able to do in life.
And in spite of all of that, it was still kind of impossible to imagine Alex Smith at age 36 suiting up and taking the field again, and yet we just watched that live.
Alex Smith is going to have his first snaps in a game in 693 days.
And he's got a two-minute drill to run with three timeouts, down 20-7 to the Rams.
So, Bill, what did you see from that scene, that weird, dramatic, inspiring scene with the Washington football team and Alex Smith?
Yeah, it was just surreal and nerve-wracking, stressful. I mean, Alex Smith was playing behind an offensive line which absolutely, positively had no hope of blocking Aaron Donald and the rest of the Rams front seven, which means really from the second snap he took, he was scrambling, he was taking hits, Aaron Donald was on his back. I mean, it was not this sort of game where it was a player being protected. Alex Smith was in the thick of it pretty much from the moment he got on the field. When he wasn't being sacked, his average pass traveled just 4.4 yards in the air. It's absolutely incredible that Smith made it back onto the field. But I think even he would tell you, in terms of his comeback, even though he's taken a major, major step, he's still a work in progress.
I'd be lying if I was saying there weren't a lot of days when I didn't think it was going to happen. But, you know, you just kind of keep pushing through.
All right, Bill, let's get to the fun stuff finally, because as incredible goes, what we saw in the AFC West with John Gruden and the Las Vegas Raiders handing Andy Reid and Pat Mahomes and the Chiefs their first loss of the season, in large part because the Raiders defense was able to shut down Mahomes, who still made, you know, his customary holy shit, how do you do that kind of throws. But how exactly did the Raiders manage to do this to Patrick Mahomes and win this game?
Well, Pablo, there's legend, and then there's the actual truth. After this game, we got a bit of the legend from Raiders defensive end Max Crosby, who said, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said the Raiders' coverages and pressures were deliberately repetitive in the first half to mix it up and throw Mahomes off in the second half.
Wait, deliberately repetitive, meaning what?
I guess just allowing the Chiefs to move the ball at will and score 24 points just so the Raiders could get them back in the second half. If you know that they had us in the first half beam, it was that, but in NFL form. I love a good long con, but I have to admit, Pablo, if the plan was for the Raiders to allow the Chiefs to score 24 points in the first half, it's a bad plan. But it kind of worked, because what we saw after halftime really was a combination of factors. The Raiders stopped the Chiefs on four consecutive third downs to start their half. That's the first time that's happened all season. And I'd love to tell you there was some secret formula that was revealed on tape, but there really wasn't one. It really was more that the Raiders just executed very well and the Chiefs did not execute well. They failed on a third and two jet sweep. They had two receivers on fourth down run into the same space, running a similar route, which allowed Jeff Heath to come over the top and pick off Mahomes and set up a short Raiders touchdown.
Here's Mahomes back into the pocket. It holds, fires deep down the middle, intercepted. It is picked off by the Raiders. Jeff Heath, 20, 15, 10, 5. Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby. First down and goal at the 2-yard line.
As much as it was about the defense as well, you can't beat Patrick Mahomes with a gimmick. You can't rope-a-dope him. What you can do to beat him is to get a complete performance on both sides of the football. And the Raiders did that, especially in the second half on Sunday.
So the biggest downfield threat on Sunday turned out to be someone that I had given, I will be honest here, 0 seconds of thought before he emerged in this game, that the Steelers ended up winning 38-29 over the Eagles. And I'm referring, of course, to the immortal Chase Claypool, the pride of Canada. So he became the first rookie, Bill, in NFL history with three receiving touchdowns and a rushing touchdown in a single game. It was unbelievable, shocking. All of those adjectives apply. And now the Steelers have their first 4-0 start since 1979. So how did Chase Claypool become the NFL's apex predator on Sunday?
He wasn't even supposed to be on the field, Papo. That's what makes this all so fascinating. He would not have been on the field in that role if Deontay Johnson had not suffered a back injury early in the game. So Claypool comes onto the field, and usually you'd figure maybe the Steelers stumble on some bad matchup, but it wasn't that. Claypool kind of went around the entire Eagles secondary, just embarrassing everyone. Early in the game, he beat Jalen Mills, a corner who was converted to safety and then recently back to cornerback, for a touchdown.
Roethlisberger to throw on third down. In the seam, he's got Claypool. Eludes a man, 15, 10, 5 toward the right pylon. Touchdown, Steelers!
Later in the game, the Steelers moved him to the opposite side of the field, and they got a big play with Claypool against Darius Slay, who's one of the highest paid cornerbacks in all of football.
Roethlisberger throws it out. Wide receiver screen. Claypool past the blockers and the defenders. Touchdown, Pittsburgh.
And then the touchdown that sealed the game up was a simple seam route where the Eagles were expecting a run and strangely didn't seem to pay much attention to Claypool at all.
off the right hash, takes the snap, looks left, now throws over the middle. Wide open, caught at the 10. Claypool is going to cruise into the end zone. Touchdown, Pittsburgh.
Since 2009, the Steelers have drafted Mike Wallace, Antonio Brown, Emmanuel Sanders, Juju Smith-Schuster, Deontay Johnson, and of course now Chase Claypool, in addition to a handful of other contributors at wide receiver, all without using a single first-round pick on any of those players. The Steelers are just simply wideout whisperers, and that is what's happened, and Chase Claypool seems to be the latest in that group of talented wideouts.
All right, coming up, speaking of defying mathematics itself, the latest on how the NFL game schedule is going to change because of all these COVID postponements, and what the hell that means for teams.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Bill, there was news, I think, every day this week on more positive tests for coronavirus from the Titans and the Patriots. And we could talk forever about who knew what and when and what high schools were these teams surreptitiously working out at, whether teams might be penalized for said workouts. But for now, let's just focus on what is happening to the NFL schedule, because the NFL released this document that detailed the brand new slate of dates, and it's affecting teams like the Broncos and the Chargers and the Jets that aren't even involved directly in any of the offenses that were just described. So why did the schedule change so much, and why did it affect so many other teams?
Well, Pablo, the NFL is trying their best to pretend that every schedule change is going to be the last schedule change and that there will be no other issues in the future. And they're trying to keep the schedule within the classic 17-week structure. They don't want to add an 18th week. They don't want to push back the playoffs. They especially do not want to push back the Super Bowl. The problem is that as we start hitting bye weeks, the league is going to have fewer options, fewer open weeks, and less flexibility to work with, which means that one team's outbreak is going to impact more and more of the league. With Tennessee's outbreak, for example, the league was actually pretty lucky. They were able to move one Steelers-Ravens game, and that was a relatively easy swap. The move to push the Patriots-Broncos game back a week on Sunday, though, that impacted half of the AFC. Every change that happens from here on out is going to have those sort of consequences.
And those consequences involve some teams getting more rest before really crucial matchups, other teams getting the exact opposite. So who's getting hit the hardest, Bill, from this slate of changes?
Okay, so I know that they don't really matter all that much because they're basically out of the playoff race, but I feel bad for the Broncos in this situation. They had to practice all week this week as if they were going to play the Patriots on Monday, only for week five after the fact to turn into their bye week. So when you're supposed to be resting, the Broncos are practicing. Now they have to play every single week for the remainder of the season. If we're thinking about contenders, I do have to feel for the Bills here, because they already had their week five game against Tennessee pushed back to Tuesday when nobody wants to play. And now, even though their week six game against the Chiefs did get pushed back to Monday afternoon, they're playing on a short week for them against the Chiefs, who will have two extra days of rest. Andy Reid's record with extra time to prepare is immaculate. And while the Bills are one of the best teams in football, I know that the Chiefs just lost. I know that the Raiders just established a rope-a-dope formula to beat the Chiefs. I just wouldn't want to give Andy Reid and Patrick Mahomes extra advantages when it comes to rest for this, what is going to be a crucial, crucial AFC matchup.
Bill Barnwell, I wish you extra days of rest, but I feel like that is not in your future.
If the NFL wanted to take a month-long break, I would not be opposed to the idea.
Bill, thank you. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.